I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
He's looking at you, kid.
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Oh, I've been thinking.
Well, what did you want to do that for?
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
They call me Mr. Tibbs.
Hello and welcome to 99 Years 100 Films, the podcast where we look at every winner of the Best Picture Academy Award in release order and see why the film is so highly regarded. This time, Trey and I are looking at Kramer vs. Kramer from 1979. How are you doing, Trey?
Good. How are you, Blaine?
I'm good. So, minor scarring by the eye, but I should be okay.
Gotta watch out for those jungle gems.
Yes. So this was released on December 19th, 1979. It was based on an Avery Corman novel published in 1977, and it was adapted into a screenplay and directed by Robert Benton. It's a name that doesn't jump out at me. I think it's going to be our first in-depth discussion of him. Mm-hmm. So the basic plot. Ted Kramer, a workaholic advertising executive in New York City, has just landed an important account and been promoted. However, when he shares the news with his wife, Joanna, he discovers that she is leaving him and their son, Billy. Initially, Ted and Billy struggle to bond as Ted's workload increases and Billy misses his mother. Nevertheless, they eventually learn to cope and form a strong connection. Ted befriends his neighbor, Margaret Phelps, to whom Joanna had confided. As fellow single parents, Ted and Margaret become close friends. While watching their children play in the park, Billy falls off the jungle gym and is injured. Ted rushes him to the hospital and comforts him during the treatment. 15 months later, Joanna returns from California to claim custody of Billy, leading to a contentious legal battle. Their lawyers resort to brutal character assassinations, and Margaret is compelled to testify against Ted, revealing that she had advised Joanna to leave him. Ted's job loss and Billy's accident are also used to discredit him. Despite his desire to appeal, Ted's lawyer advises against it, as putting Billy on the stand would be emotionally damaging. Ted eventually decides not to contest custody. On the day Joanna comes to collect Billy, Ted and Billy prepare breakfast together. Joanna tells Ted that she wishes she had painted Billy's new room like his old one, and tearfully admits that his true home is with Ted. As she enters the elevator to talk to Billy one last time, Ted tells her she looks terrific. So that plot summary is courtesy of the contributors at Wikipedia. It's very brief compared to usual.
It is.
Yeah, partly because it's easy to summarize, and partly because I think they've ignored Einstein's advice. One of my favorite Einstein quotes when he was asked how he felt about the mass newspaper coverage of the theory of relativity is when he said, things should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. And I think this may be over-summarized. So a couple quick comments. When it says 15 months later, Joanna returns, that's not 15 months after the accident, that's 15 months after she walks out. That's a little ambiguous in terms of how it's phrased.
Right, and I don't know if even the 15 months is accurate, because when she first approaches Ted, she makes a comment that she's been secretly watching Billy at school for a while.
Yeah, it was 15 months when she initiated the custody battle. But yeah, she had been back watching earlier. And it wasn't really Ted's lawyer advising against putting Billy on the stand in the appeal. He just said, okay, we can't appeal. Understand Billy's going to have to be on the stand. And it's Ted who says, I'm not putting him through that.
Right. And it also glosses over a little bit his job loss. So as Ted settles more into the role of single parent, I don't want to say he's not doing his job, but he's not putting in the 60-hour work week that it demanded before, and his boss lets him go because of that. And then he quickly takes, I think like it's something like in a marathon two-day session, right? He takes a lower-paying position with a rival firm just to make sure that he is employed by the time of the custody hearing.
Yeah, I'm not even sure if it was a two-day session. He literally gets the call saying, okay, they set the court date the day he lost his job, and he says, I will have a job tomorrow, and he did.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is, you know, summarized a little briefly. They hit the main points. There's just some details that, as we're discussing, are probably going to come up that were not reflected by this plot summary. I mean, I also, And it mentions that, yeah, this is really about, you know, about how he and Billy are going through. Right, yeah, it's actually before the plot summary, where they say it tells the story of a couple's divorce, its impact on their young son, and the subsequent evolution of their relationship and views on parenting. We see some of the impact on the son, but really, this is Ted's story.
It is. And when you see how much actual screen time Meryl Streep has in it as Joanna, you'll understand why she was best supporting and not best actress.
Yeah, because the movie is an hour and 45 minutes, and I think there's probably over an hour in the middle where she's simply not present.
Yeah,
it's very much Ted's story, and that first scene where she's leaving him, we see enough from that conversation to get that, yeah, if this is a typical interaction, he isn't listening to her. But just that's where they start, is where Ted finds out about the divorce and not the years of unhappiness that led Joanna to ask for the divorce. And then, you know, she has gone through therapy. She's moved to California. But we learn all this through exposition. She walks out and we don't see her again until she's walking back in their lives saying, we actually see her watching before she approaches Ted. And we find out she's gunning for custody. I don't think there's ever a scene in here with Joanna without Ted. I think Ted is in every scene, if I'm remembering this correctly.
The only scene that he's not in, and I guess that it depends on how you kind of think about what is a scene. You know, there's maybe 5 minutes where she's waiting for him to come home that he's not in, but he's in every other second of the movie. And you mentioned the divorce. That them not being together is not glossed over. I don't mean that, but the actual civil proceedings are completely glossed over in the film, to where, you know, I was wondering, was there even a divorce case, or was this one of those things to where a lawyer drew up papers were mailed across country, they were signed, and it was signed, sealed, and delivered. Not that it matters, but I think today you would have maybe a 15-minute court scene of the actual divorce proceedings.
Yeah, I think today we would have... I don't think we'd see an hour and 45-minute movie. I think we'd see a 2.5-hour movie that spent a lot more time with Joanna.
Yeah.
In this year as she was getting things reconciled. But again, when this movie was made, society in general, in the West, perhaps not as bad as other places in the world, but for the most part, men have it easier than women. Custody battles are one of the few cases where women have the advantage. And here in 1979, it was a very decided advantage. So I suspect that's why they chose to tell this from the dad's side, because we see that, yeah, Ted's employer is asking for him to be available 24/7. He promises that. But when he loses the job and it comes out in court, every single time he was messing up at work, it's because he made his son the priority. And he's just not there 24/7. I think in the recent years, I'm starting to see more movement pushing back against that 24/7 work ideology, but that was very much a thing in the 70s. So they bring it up here, but that's not the focus. It's, you know, it's just, well, Ted can't do the job because that's what the job is, and no one stops to say, well, should any job be asking for this?
Right. I found this to be not odd in a bad way, but I don't know if it could... It seemed very conflicted. It doesn't want... I don't think it necessarily sets out to vilify Joanna necessarily, but the sympathies are definitely with Ted. And at the same time, they don't present Ted to be perfect. And you can tell it's at this weird transitional time to where it wants to be more fair to women, and yet it still kind of takes the angle that Joanna had a role and a duty, and she abandoned that role and duty. Ted's still very much an aggressor in some scenes, but he's also supposed to be kind of the more sensitive male figure, to where, like you said, family's first, that we kind of see becoming more of a popular culture role model in the late 70s, early 80s. I just found some weird from today's lens, there's some odd juxtapositions in it.
There is. I mean, when we see the first 5 or 10 minutes, it is hard to like Ted because it is clear he is a terrible husband. Right? We see that Joanna needs to have a conversation, and he's trying to avoid it. And then when she says, "I'm leaving you," it's, "Oh, don't, you don't really mean that. Come on, let's talk. Let's." He's not taking her concern seriously. We do see tremendous growth from Ted as the film progresses. So, yeah, I think had she sued for custody at the time of the divorce, from what we'd seen of them, I don't think people would have objected if she got full custody. But the person Ted becomes in those 15 months is a different story.
Yes and no. I think Ted becomes a better father. I don't know that he would be a better husband.
Yep. Yeah, that's for sure. So, just from the custody perspective, the every other weekend and one dinner a week doesn't feel like enough when we've seen what he's put in. Mm-hmm. But that's, again, not atypical of custody decisions at the time. I mean, I grew up in the 80s, and I had classmates whose parents had gone through the custody battles, and there was documentation that mom was abusive, but she got custody because she was the mom. Mm-hmm. And that was the attitude. I mean, there are issues, but I just feel part of our reaction is going to be because the cultural conversation has changed and the cultural priorities have changed. So the elements that would be the talking points if they made this film today were not the major talking points when they made it in 1979. So the other thing I want to mention from the synopsis, they mentioned that she's going in the elevator to talk to Billy one last time. I don't know that that's going to be the last time, right? I think she's agreed that Ted should have the majority of the custody, but I don't think she's going to walk out of Billy's life. I think Ted is going to have him more than 50% of the time, but we don't know exactly how it's going to play out.
Yeah, I agree. And when it makes the comment about where Billy's home really is, I don't think it was so much, "Ted, you can take better care of Billy than I can." I think it was more, "How much more damage am I going to do to our son by uprooting him and putting him in a strange place?"
Yeah, I got the impression that she could easily say, "No, you don't come visit me. This is his home. I'm going to come visit you."
Yeah.
Right. I don't think there's any chance of Ted and Joanna reconciling, and I don't know that there should be, but I do think that they're going to find a way. I got the impression that they will find a more reasonable way for Billy to have both parents in his life. And speaking as a teacher, I know some people will stay together for the sake of the child. I have seen so many cases where the children are better off dividing time between two happy homes rather than spending all of their time in one miserable home. Just some thought.
The only thing that really seemed odd to me, that was kind of one of those only in New York moments, and I mean, you know, if you've been to New York City, you kind of get it. It is, while it is large in terms of population, it is somewhat small in terms of size. And of course, this is an age when there's not cell phones or anything, right? But the running to the hospital, the literal running, the 4 or 5 blocks, whatever it was, to the hospital, as opposed to, you know, someone calling an ambulance. That's just not something that would happen here.
No, yeah, that was definitely a product of its time.
I'm still not clear. Like, I understand that he fell from the jungle gym, but I would have thought that would have led to maybe some bruising. I'm still not quite sure how he got the cuts on his face.
Yeah, it's got to be something that he landed on, because he was falling kind of face first. But yeah, it doesn't seem to make a huge amount of sense. But the main thing is, yeah, it's a normal playground accident. It wasn't serious, but could have been if he landed slightly differently. But I think from that fall, it also could have been nothing if he'd landed slightly differently. It was just enough to give them ammunition in court. And it's also, I've been told that I saw this in theaters when it came out. So I would have been 2 when we saw this, because I'm guessing we would have seen it in 1980, probably after it won the award. And when that happened, and, you know, the audience reacted to seeing Billy injured, apparently 2-year-old me tried to reassure the audience by calling out quite loudly, "Don't worry, it's only just ketchup." So for the blood. It was a prop blood. So yes, this is probably, actually I'm sure this is the first Best Picture winner that I have, that I actually saw in the theater.
I probably saw it around 3 or 4, but not in the theater. My parents were an early adopter of cable and HBO, and I think it was one of the films, like, and I don't say this to denigrate my parents, but, you know, there was a time when parents just assumed kids weren't paying attention to the TV, if you know what I mean. Shows that weren't aimed at the kids weren't on. But I remember my father getting flustered with the, I'm blanking on her name, Jo Beth Williams nudity, because he hadn't seen the movie. He and my mom were watching it for the first time on television, and that scene happened, and it was the, did Trey just get his first glimpse of nudity? I remember him being all flustered about it. But that's why it sticks out in my memory, if that makes sense. I don't think I saw it to where I could appreciate it until the 90s.
Okay. Yeah. So you remember the reaction your parents had to watching it more than remember watching it the first time. But yeah, this is actually just the second time in my life that I've seen it, which is going to be a theme. I've only fallen asleep in movies in the theater twice, and both of those won Best Picture in the 1980s, so we'll see what happens when I watch them again when I am old enough to appreciate them, I hope.
So let's talk about the performances a bit. What did you think of Dustin Hoffman in this?
He did a very good job in this. Apparently he initially turned down the role when it was offered because he was going through a divorce at the time. And he's also very much into method acting, so I guess there was some strain between him and Streep on the set because his character was a jerk to her, and because he was a method actor, that meant he had to be a jerk to her in a variety of ways. So
I was reading about that on Wikipedia, and there is a slight timing error. So they kind of quote her in an interview, and I'm not saying that she didn't say it, and I am not saying that he wasn't cold or mean to her. There's an offhand reference to it being her first take in her first film, and this couldn't be her first take in her first film because she was in Deer Hunter, which filmed before this.
Yeah, and the trivia on Deer Hunter explicitly states that these filmmakers asked her to come in and read for the part because of her work in Deer Hunter. So I don't know who would have suggested that this was her first film.
So if that was an actual quote from Meryl Streep, I'm not saying that she misremembered the events, but I think she misremembered when they happened.
Yeah. I don't know. Unless the... Yeah. It could have been, you know, one of those things where your memory blurs it. It might have been one of her more vivid memories because of how emotionally intense it was trying to work with Hoffman at the time.
Yeah, I think the scene where she tells him that she wants custody and he smashes the wine glass against the wall, he improvised that, and she was not expecting it.
Yeah, it says that he warned the cameraman that it was going to happen. He didn't warn her, and she ended up with glass in her hair. So, yeah, so it's the quote, I've seen the quote now, and yeah, it was a quote that she gave in 2018. So, yeah, and it was the scene where he slapped her quite hard for real, so.
I thought she had a hard role to play, because like I said, the film doesn't quite vilify Joanna, but it, you know, I don't know, it's that hard road, because from what we're seeing, Ted was maybe emotionally abusive in that he was distant and he didn't listen, and he worked long hours, and he left all of the dealing with the house to her, and that wasn't fulfilling for her, and that's not what she wanted to do.
Yeah, I see a lot of neglect, but no malice from Ted to Joanna.
Exactly. So, you know, there was no affair, he wasn't abusive, and even though it's trying to be feminist, it keeps pinging that how dare a mother leave their child, and the second you walked out the door, you know, you gave up all your rights. So, at the same time, it's not fair to her because it presents her as a failure, and that had to be a tough role to play.
Yeah, does a very good job of justifying her walking out on him very quickly. Because that's, I mean, might be 5-6 minutes in when we know that's happening, and we understand and support that choice. But it makes very little attempt to justify her coming for custody. Mm-hmm. I mean, we essentially see her saying goodbye to Billy. Billy doesn't know that's what she's doing. But, you know, she puts him in bed, and that's it. So we don't see nearly as much from her. And I guess she asked to be shown more sympathetically and have more footage with that, and Hoffman fought against it. Which, again, I don't know how much of Hoffman, like we said, he was going through a divorce in his personal life at this time. So it's hard to say how much of his own decisions were being influenced, how much of what he wanted from his own life was impacting the way he was handling this film.
Yeah, was he projecting onto her?
Yeah. It doesn't attempt to make a strong case for her winning custody of this child, but I think that's the point, because as we said, at this time, custody hearings very rarely went well for the father. And I suspect that was part of the point, was to make you understand, no, Ted has become a very good father. He is a capable single parent, and now she's taking him away. So I haven't read the source material. I don't know if that's an accurate reflection of Avery Corman's novel, or if that's just the piece that they pulled out and chose to focus on for the film. But that's the message I'm getting from this. And I just wish that they had spent more time talking about whether or not his employer had the right to demand 24/7. Like, I mean, Ted objects to being fired. He doesn't object to what the job is asking him to do. Mm-hmm. Right? Oddly, I don't remember seeing any pushback on that. Maybe I just missed the movies that discussed it, but the earliest movie I remember that has any conversation on that is Mr. Mom, of all things.
When it became a topic in the 80s, it was less about what right did the employer have to demand those things, and it was more in films along these lines, like you mentioned Mr. Mom, to where it's the role of the father changing from provider to caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when in reality, for both parents in a healthy relationship, it should be equal parts both on both parties, you know.
Yep.
But this was still a time to where, you know, one party had one role and the other had the other. And this was still in an era to where people were saying, yes, it is okay for a woman to work if she's not a mother. If she's not a mother. And if she is a mother, she must do both.
Yeah. Yeah, it's getting there. And this is just one of the films that brings that up that doesn't really emphasize how tough it is for the woman. Most do. Because again, it is better today, but it's far from corrected mm-hmm. and fair and equitable. And again, like I said, that whole, yeah, you're on call 24/7 is not a reasonable expectation.
Now, and in some ways, we haven't come too far from this. I mean, you know, I don't know a lot of fathers who work 24/7, but I do know a lot who still try to enforce kind of that paradigm of I work, I come home, I expect the house to be in order, I expect dinner to be taken care of, I will put in an obligatory half an hour with the children, and then the rest of the time is mine. You know what I mean? To where it still doesn't feel like there's an equal partnership there. I think that still goes on more than it should in our society today, at least in the West.
Yeah, but I think we're largely on the same page ourselves, given that we are both husbands and fathers, and we're scheduling these podcasts at 6 a.m. on a Sunday morning in my time zone, because then we're not neglecting family, because it's our time, because we're the only ones awake.
Right.
So, but yes, they're how an individual couple works out the balance is up to them. You know, if it's a single income family, and that's enough to support, fine. But, you know, if I'm of the attitude that if, you know, one of you is working 40 hours a week and that's enough to cover it, and there's 60 hours of housework to do, then the person who's doing 40 hours a week does at least 10 hours of the housework, so you're doing the 50 hours each.
Right.
And take it that way. But anyway, back to the movie.
That was all on topic, I promise.
It was, yes. So shall we start going through the nominations and awards?
Sure.
All right, so the 52nd Annual Academy Awards ceremony took place on April 14th, 1980, hosted by Johnny Carson. So the Best Picture Award clearly went to Kramer vs. Kramer, beating out All That Jazz, Apocalypse Now, Breaking Away, and Norma Rae. Which, and I just talked about how maybe the work-life balance wasn't addressed, but now that I see Norma Rae on the list, I haven't seen it yet, but maybe that addresses that thing that I said wasn't being addressed. I may have just missed that one. Best Director went to Robert Benton for Kramer vs. Kramer. He beat out Bob Fosse for All That Jazz, Francis Ford Coppola for Apocalypse Now, Peter Yates for Breaking Away, and Eduardo Molinaro for La Cage aux Folles, which I'm hoping I didn't butcher that too much. I would suggest that Western audiences are probably more familiar with the remake from the 90s titled The Birdcage, with Nathan Lane and Robin Williams. Best Actor went to Dustin Hoffman for Kramer vs. Kramer, beating out Jack Lemmon for The China Syndrome, Al Pacino for Injustice for All, Roy Scheider for All That Jazz, and Peter Sellers for Being There. Best Actress went to Sally Field for her role as Norma Rae, beating out Jill Claiborne from Starting Over, Jane Fonda for The China Syndrome, Marsha Mason for Chapter 2, and Bette Midler for The Rose. Best Supporting Actor went to Melvin Douglas for Being There, beating out Robert Duvall for Apocalypse Now, Frederick Forrest for The Rose, Justin Henry for Kramer vs. Kramer, and he played Billy, so that's the 7-year-old who got that nomination, and also beating out Mickey Rooney for The Black Stallion. Best Supporting Actress went to Meryl Streep for Kramer vs. Kramer, beating out Jane Alexander, who was also nominated for Kramer vs. Kramer, Barbara Barry for Breaking Away, Candace Bergen for Starting Over, and Mariel Hemingway for Manhattan. The best screenplay written directly for the screen went to Breaking Away and Steve Tesich, beating out All That Jazz and Justice for All, The China Syndrome, and Manhattan. Best screenplay based on material from another medium, that went to Kramer vs. Kramer, beating out Apocalypse Now, La Cage aux Folles, A Little Romance, and Norma Rae. Best foreign language film went to The Tin Drum, which makes me wonder if La Cage aux Folles was even submitted in this category, considering how many nominations it had outside. But that was a German film that beat out The Maids of Wilko from Poland, Mama Turns 100 from Spain, A Simple Story from France, and To Forget Venice from Italy. Best documentary feature went to Best Boy by Ira Wall, beating out Generation on the Wind, Going the Distance, The Killing Ground, and The War at Home. Best documentary short subject went to Paul Robeson, Tribute to an Artist. That beat out Day, Coria Celadon, Nails, and Remember Me. Best live-action short film went to Board and Care, beating out Bravery in the Field, Oh Brother, My Brother, The Solar Film, and Sully's Diner. The best animated short film went to Every Child, beating out Dream Doll and It's So Nice to Have a Wolf Around the House. It's getting to the point where I don't even recognize the best animated short films anymore.
I think, though, for the past at least 3 years, they've all been Canadian.
A lot of them are, because that's... Yeah, that one was National Film Board of Canada in association with UNICEF. So there's a bit of history to that. When Norman McLaren was made the minister in charge of entertainment for Canada, he figured, we cannot compete with the Hollywood resources, so let's focus on developing areas that Hollywood's not focused on, namely animation and documentaries. So Best Original Score went to A Little Romance by George Delure, beat out 10 by Henry Mancini, Amityville Horror by Lalo Schifrin, who I know best for doing the Mission Impossible theme, The Champ by David Grusin, and Star Trek The Motion Picture by Jerry Goldsmith. Fun fact I recently learned, Jerry Goldsmith, Henry Mancini, and John Williams were good friends who knew each other because they had the same piano teacher. So anyone who questions the impact a teacher can have, Henry Mancini, Jerry Goldsmith, and John Williams had the same teacher. In fact, John Williams played the piano piece on the original recording of the Pink Panther theme. Best Original Song Score and its Adaptation. That went to All That Jazz, beating out Breaking Away and The Muppet Movie. Best Original Song. It Goes Like It Goes from Norma Rae. Beat out I'll Never Say Goodbye from The Promise. It's Easy to Say from 10. Rainbow Connection from The Muppet Movie, and Through the Eyes of Love from Ice Castles. Rainbow Connection is the only one of those I can remember. How about you?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's been fun with the best original song lately, because it's, which one of those do you still hear? You know? And I think Rainbow Connection is the only one that, you know, if you presented it to this list to someone, that people would say, yes, I've heard that one before.
Yep. That's the one where I would say, yes, I've heard of that one before. Anyway, Best Sound went to Apocalypse Now, beating out 1941 Electric Horseman, Meteor, and The Rose. Best Costume Design went to All That Jazz, beating out Agatha, Butch and Sundance, The Early Days, The Europeans, and La Cage aux Folles. Best Art Direction went to All That Jazz, beating out Alien, Apocalypse Now, The China Syndrome, and Star Trek The Motion Picture. Best Cinematography went to Apocalypse Now, beating out 1941, All That Jazz, The Black Hole, and Kramer vs. Kramer. Best Film Editing went to All That Jazz, beating out Apocalypse Now, The Black Stallion, Kramer vs. Kramer, and The Rose. And Best Visual Effects went to Alien, beating out 1941, The Black Hole, Moonraker, and Star Trek The Motion Picture. Now, the honorary awards. Hal Elias got an award for his dedication and distinguished service to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. And Alec Guinness got one for advancing the art of screen acting through a host of memorable and distinguished performances. The Jean Hersholt Humanitarian Award went to Robert Benjamin, who was a founding partner of the movie litigation firm Phillips Neiser Benjamin Krim and Ballon, and a former co-chair of United Artists and a founding member of Orion Pictures. That's what comes up in the pop-up. That's not necessarily what he won the award for, because I don't know if Orion Pictures exists yet. Mm-mm. But I'm sure that's an indication of, you know, why it's there. The Irving Jean Thalberg Memorial Award went to Ray Stark. The Special Achievement Award went to Alan Splett for the sound effects editing in The Black Stallion. The Academy Award for Technical Achievement went to Marc Serurier for the progressive development of the Moviola from 1924, invention of his father, to the present Series 20 sophisticated film editing equipment. Now, we had a lot of films with multiple nominations this year.
So just real quick, because you mentioned it, I looked it up. Orion Films was actually founded in 1978. The first films that they would produce wouldn't be released until 1979, though.
Okay, so that would have been something he had recently done. Okay, so the multiple nominations. All That Jazz and Kramer vs. Kramer had 9 nominations each. Apocalypse Now had 8. Breaking Away had 5. China Syndrome, Norma Rae, and The Rose each had 4. 1941, La Cage aux Folles, and Star Trek The Motion Picture each had 3. And there were 2 awards each, or 2 nominations each, for Alien and Justice for All, Being There, The Black Hole, The Black Stallion, A Little Romance, Manhattan, The Muppet Movie, Starting Over, and 10. Now, all that said, there's only 4 movies that won multiple awards. Kramer vs. Kramer won 5, All That Jazz won 4, and Apocalypse Now and Norma Rae won 2 each. All right, so, did you have any general thoughts?
You know, nothing that I really disagreed with. You know, we really didn't talk about Jane Alexander. I thought she did a really good job as Margaret. You know, we talked about the 2.5-hour version that would be made today. This film is so tight. They go from being antagonist, because she's Joanna's friend and fellow stay-at-home mom and wife, to being Ted's friend because they're fellow single parents. That 2.5-hour version that we talked about, when it gets remade today, I would like to see it spend some time showing that transition, because I thought that was a good relationship.
It was, although it's interesting. Her first scene is when she's saying, no, I had nothing to do with this. And then on the stand, she admits that, yeah, she did kind of suggest it, but not thinking that Joanna would actually take that suggestion. It was more of a spur-of-the-moment comment thing, rather than actual advice, more just thinking out loud. But yeah, one thing about this film, it is so character-driven rather than plot-driven. It only works if all of the performances are great, and I think they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, Kramer vs. Kramer, again, nominated for 9 awards, took home 5. Because Meryl Streep and Jane Alexander were nominated in the same category, it would have been very difficult to win all 9. it would have been easier to win 8. Because, you know, it's hard to get a statistical tie, especially when you're looking at 5 people in the category. When, if Meryl Streep and Jane Alexander were close to tying, they probably would have split the vote enough that someone else would have won entirely. So, yeah, I don't know if we... Did you have any other comments on the Academy Awards here? Or?
I guess 1941 proves that you can be a box office bomb and still rack up multiple nominations.
Yeah, it's often joked about as being one of Spielberg's worst films. And yet, here it is getting nominated 3 times. Again, Best Visual Effects, Best Cinematography, and Best Sound. So, more on the technical side and less on the storytelling side.
But still, Best Cinematography means that people thought it was one of the best shot films of the year.
Yep. And I guess Star Trek The Motion Picture is starting to get a little more support now. It's got a notorious reputation claiming it lost money. It didn't, by the way. Yeah, $44 million budget, partly because it absorbed all the costs of the Star Trek Phase 2 TV series that didn't happen.
Right.
So they spend about $6 billion developing a TV series that never happened, and they tacked it onto the movie budget. But even then, $44 million budget, and it brought in $139 million at the box office. So with that 2-3 times rule, it still made money. It was just not considered particularly successful because the investors were promised Star Wars-level profits, and that's not what it generated. So everyone made money, just not as much as they were promised. So that's why it got the reputation for being a failure. It's just, yeah. So it underperformed, but it did not fail in any sense. Financially, anyway. Which is funny, considering that was essentially a work print. Yeah, but this isn't really the Star Trek Motion Picture podcast. But yeah, the director's cut we finally got on DVD. Robert Wise didn't have a chance to do the director's cut. It was so rushed. That was really a work print. He was not happy with the finished product, even in 1979.
One other thing on Robert Benjamin. The award was actually a posthumous award. He had passed away in October of 79.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Any more discussion of the Oscars, or shall we go to the Golden Globes?
Let's go to the Golden Globes.
All right, so the 37th annual Golden Globes took place on January 26, 1980. Best Motion Picture Drama went to Kramer vs. Kramer, beating out Apocalypse Now, The China Syndrome, Manhattan, and Norma Rae. And Best Comedy or Musical went to Breaking Away, beating out 10, Being There, Hair, and The Rose. Best Performance in a Drama Actor went to Dustin Hoffman for Kramer vs. Kramer, beating out Jack Lemmon, Al Pacino, John Voight, and James Woods. Similar lineup there. Mm-hmm. Best Actress, also Sally Field for Norma Rae, beating out Jill Clayborne, Lisa Eichhorn, Jane Fonda, and Marcia Mason. Best Performance in a Motion Picture, Comedy, or Musical. Actor went to Peter Sellers for Being There, beating out George Hamilton for Love at First Bite, Dudley Moore for 10, Burt Reynolds for Starting Over, and Roy Scheider for All That Jazz. Actress went to Bette Midler for The Rose, beating out Julie Andrews in 10, Jill Clayborne in Starting Over, Shirley MacLaine in Being There, and Marcia Mason for Chapter 2. Best Supporting Actor, so this is drama, comedy, and musical combined. Supporting Actor was a tie between Melvin Douglas for Being There and Robert Duvall for Apocalypse Now. They beat out Frederick Forrest for The Rose, Justin Henry for Kramer vs. Kramer, and Laurence Olivier for A Little Romance. So again, Justin Henry nominated by the Golden Globes as well. Supporting Actress went to Meryl Streep for Kramer vs. Kramer, beating out Jane Alexander for Kramer vs. Kramer, Kathleen Beller, Candice Bergen, and Valerie Harper. Other awards. Best Director went to Francis Ford Coppola for Apocalypse Now, beating out Hal Ashby for Being There, Robert Benton for Kramer vs. Kramer, James Bridges for The China Syndrome, and Peter Yates for Breaking Away. Best Screenplay, Kramer vs. Kramer, beat out Being There, Breaking Away, China Syndrome, and Norma Rae. Best Original Score went to Apocalypse Now, by Carmine and Francis Ford Coppola. So beating out Henry Mancini for 10, Jerry Goldsmith for Alien, Amityville Horror for Lalo Schifrin, Black Stallion for Carmine Coppola, Little Romance for George Delarue, and Jerry Goldsmith nominated again for Star Trek The Motion Picture, which some of that I think they swapped his themes because it's very somber at first, but the closing credits were later reused as the opening theme for Star Trek The Next Generation.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of the more memorable Star Trek themes. Best Original Song was the title song for The Rose, beating out Better Than Ever from Starting Over, The Main Event, which is the title song from that film, Rainbow Connection from the Muppet Movie, and Through the Eyes of Love from Ice Castles. I didn't even know that that movie existed.
What movie?
Ice Castles.
Oh yeah, that's a ice skating film.
Yes, that's what I'm seeing here. Romantic drama film about Lexi Winston, a young figure skater, and her rise and fall from superstardom. New Star of the Year actor, Ricky Schroeder from The Champ. Hey, for once, the guy we've heard of actually wins, instead of just being nominated. He beat out Dennis Christopher for Breaking Away, Justin Henry for Kramer vs. Kramer, Dean Paul Martin for Players, and Treat Williams for Hair. New Star of the Year actress went to Bette Midler for The Rose, her to her too, beating out Susan Anton for Golden Girl, Bo Derek for 10, Lisa Eichhorn for Yanks, and Lynn Holly Johnston for Ice Castles. And Best Foreign Film here went to La Cage aux Folles, beating out the Europeans, The Marriage of Maria Braun, Soldier of Orange, and Till Marriage Do Us Part. So, multiple nominations. Kramer vs. Kramer was up for 8, Being There for 6, China Syndrome, The Rose, and 10 were up for 5 each, Apocalypse Now, Breaking Away, and Starting Over for 4, Normandy for 3, and The Champ, Chapter 2, Hair, Ice Castles, A Little Romance, Promises in the Dark, and Yanks got 2 nominations each. And then Kramer vs. Kramer won 4, Apocalypse Now and The Rose each won 3, and Being There won 2. Quick run through the television series, or do you want to, any comments on the films first?
No, you know, I thought it was notable that it didn't take Best Director. Having seen both of the films, and you know, I kind of rushed us through it, and I wish I hadn't, because we hadn't really talked about if we agreed with the Academy or not for Best Picture. The ones that I've seen are Kramer versus, in recent memory, that I could judge, are Kramer versus Kramer and Apocalypse Now. Apocalypse Now is a good movie, but it's not like the greatest Vietnam film ever or this great war epic like some folks think it is, or at least it's not in my opinion. So I do think Kramer versus Kramer's the better film. I think maybe the Golden Globes was awarding complexity over quality. Not that, like I said, I'm not saying that Apocalypse Now isn't a quality film, but I think sometimes people think modern day urban setting, good cast, the director has it, easy, versus helicopters, explosions, overseas, malaria, you know what I mean? So I don't know that I'm not necessarily in that crowd that makes me say, oh, well, yeah, because he had a more complex film, Francis Ford Coppola was the better director.
That's true. And Francis Ford Coppola had, yeah, saying it's a character piece makes it easier. This is also a character piece with a lot of location shooting, which often means you've got to get in, get your shot, and get out. That the scene where he was running the 5 blocks to the hospital, you know the film production crew had to shut down traffic on all 5 of those blocks. That there's just no other way to get that shot and to control it. So everyone driving those vehicles that were stopping for him would have been on staff. They had a moving camera that was keeping up with him as he was running. It's not automatically easy just because it's character driven. Anyway, so Golden Globes for Best TV Series. Drama went to Lou Grant, beating out Backstairs of the White House, Centennial, Dallas, The Rockford Files, and Roots, The Next Generation. Musical or comedy, there was a tie between Alice and Taxi, beating out The Associates, The Love Boat, and MASH. Best performance in a TV series, drama. Actor went to Ed Asner for Lou Grant, beating out Richard Chamberlain for Centennial, Eric Estrada for Chips, James Garner for The Rockford Files, John Houseman for The Paper Chase, Martin Sheen for Blind Ambition, Robert Urich for Vegas, and Robert Wagner for Heart to Heart. Actress had far fewer nominations. It went to Natalie Wood for From Here to Eternity. That's the 3-part, 6-hour television miniseries that remade the Best Picture winner. And she beat out Barbara Bel Geddes for Dallas, Kate Mulgrew as Mrs. Columbo, Stephanie Powers from Heart to Heart, and Seda Thompson for Family. And for those wondering, yeah, I'm a huge Columbo fan. Not so much a Mrs. Columbo fan. And Levinson and Link, who created Columbo, were not fans of it at all, considering they had absolutely no part of it and didn't know it was even going to exist until it was being promoted after it had already been filming.
There is a film, and I'm not going to be able to remember the title of it right now, Blaine, but I think it was a made-for-TV movie that was spoofing the Sunday night mystery trend. I think it had Kevin Pollak as Columbo. It had Buck Owens as McCloud. Jamie Farr and someone else was Starsky and Hutch, and someone was parodying Ironsides, and it was kind of a "and then there were none" pastiche. And it ended up that all of the directors actually, all the detectives actually survived in ludicrous ways, and the killer was Mrs. Columbo, because she wasn't taken as seriously as the rest of them. It's a funny movie if you ever catch it. I'd have to look at Jamie Farr's filmography to see if I can remember what the title of it was, but you talking about that with Mrs. Columbo made me think of it.
Okay, yeah, I'll check into that. I did try watching Mrs. Columbo just as a Columbo fan looking for more, and it's funny how, you know, in the early part, Kate Columbo talks about her husband who's an LAPD detective, and in the second half, oh no, she's never been married. What are you talking about? I don't remember that. Ran 13 episodes. So again, I think trying to carry the Columbo brand hurt it. It was 1 hour. It had nothing in common with Columbo. I think it would have lasted more than 13 episodes had they given it an original title and billed it as an original character, which it truly was. They were just trying to bring in fandom who didn't want to follow. So, best performance in a television series, musical or comedy. Best actor went to Alan Alda for MASH, beating out Judd Hirsch for Taxi, Winfred Hyde-White for The Associates, John Ritter for Three's Company, and Robin Williams for Mork and Mindy. Best actress went to Linda Levine for Alice, beating out Penny Marshall for Laverne and Shirley, Donna Pesco for Angie, Gene Stapleton for All in the Family, and Loretta Swit for MASH. And best supporting actor in a series, miniseries, or television film. So supporting actor, that was actually a tie between Danny DeVito for Taxi and Vic Tayback for Alice, beating out Jeff Conaway for Taxi, Andy Kaufman for Taxi, and David Doyle for Charlie's Angels. A lot of talk about Taxis and Jeff Conaway today for me. We just recorded a Babylon 5 podcast where he is introduced for the first time as Zach Allen. Supporting actress. That went to Polly Holiday for Alice, beating out Lonnie Anderson for WKRP in Cincinnati, Mary Lou Henner for Taxi, Beth Howland for Alice, and Linda Kelsey for Lou Grant. Best miniseries or television film, All Quiet on the Western Front, took it home, beating out Elvis, Friendly Fire, Like Normal People, and The Miracle Worker. Funny, and remake of All Quiet on the Western Front comes home with some awards. You know, as we record a few weeks after Everything Everywhere All at Once did a nice little sweep. We'll talk about that more in a few years' time.
Yep.
So multiple nominations. Taxi was nominated for 6 awards, Alice for 5, Lou Grant and MASH for 3 each, and Centennial, Dallas, Heart to Heart, and Rockford Files for 2 each. And the programs with multiple wins, Alice won 4, and Lou Grant and Taxi won 2 each. And the Cecil B. DeMille Award went to Henry Fonda. So any thoughts on the Golden Globes?
No, it's always a nice walk down memory lane, just because, you know, I was born in 75, so, you know, these were some of the shows that were on when I was like 4, so I remember a lot of these.
Yeah, I remember watching Taxi and Alice in syndicated reruns, but yeah, mostly for the TV shows. For the dramas, Rockford Files is the only one I watched, but for the musical or comedy, I think I've seen most of them, or at least a sampling of most of them. All right, so shall we run down how these films have come out on IMDb? And Letterboxd.
Yes.
All right. So IMDb, looking at any movie released in 1979 with at least 1,000 ratings. So with that, Kramer vs. Kramer comes in at number 14 for the year, which means it's coming in behind Apocalypse Now. That came in at number 2. So looking ahead, so yeah, Kramer vs. Kramer is 14. All That Jazz is 15, so that's not far behind. Manhattan was not up for Best Picture, but it did come in at number 16. Breaking Away is number 19 for the year. And I'm just looking for Norma Rae.
Manhattan wasn't up for Best Picture at the Academy Awards, but it was one of the Best Drama nominees at the Golden Globes.
Yeah. All right, and Norma Rae, I did find it. It came in at number 54, which doesn't sound good, but a 7.3 out of 10 is a decent rating. So for the ratings for the year, it's tied with Rocky II.
Yeah, I think it's more known more for Sally Field's acceptance speech than the film itself today.
Yeah, that you like me. You really like me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just to note, the Muppet Movie comes in at number 26. But if we look at all the English language films, so other films that were not nominated that came in above this, we have The Life of, or Being There comes in at number 9. Life of Brian comes in at number 8. And then the number one rated movie for the year is Ridley Scott's Alien. That just edges out Apocalypse Now. They both round to an 8.5.
I can see that. I mean, Alien is still hailed as a horror sci-fi masterpiece. So, and rightly so. It's a great film.
Yeah, it's one of the few franchises where there's debate about whether the first is the best. I mean, we are now what? If we include the Alien vs. Predator movies, we are, I think, about 8 films deep mm-hmm. into the franchise.
I think so.
Yeah, because we had Alien, Aliens, Alien 3, Alien Resurrection, the 2 Alien vs. Predator films, Prometheus, and then Alien Covenant. And when people are debating the best films in the franchise, the conversation seems to only be about the first two. But we'll discuss Aliens in a few years, because I know Sigourney Weaver was up for her role, so it'll definitely be part of the conversation then. Mm-hmm. Shifting over to Letterboxd, Stalker is actually the number one film for the year.
That's a Russian film, right?
Yes, Andrei Tarkovsky, so I think it was the same director who did Solaris. It's number 6 on the IMDb. But yeah, I was actually surprised when I saw it there. I'm wondering if it was not in LA this year, because it is very well regarded in the, you know, the film buff groups and social media, they're definitely talking about it. But if we go through the films that we have on Letterboxd, Apocalypse Now is number 2, Alien is number 5, Doctor Who The City of Death is number 6, All That Jazz is the 9th of the year. We have a couple of Kate Bush specials in the top 12.
I wonder if those were in the top 12 a year ago.
Yeah, maybe not. So number 50 is Life of Brian, Breaking Away is 55, and Kramer vs. Kramer comes in at number 58 for the year. Manhattan is 71, and I'm seeing a lot of music videos coming in here too, because they're not being filtered out exactly. Queen music videos, like I said, the Kate Bush ones. So Mobile Suit Gundam is coming in here. Oh, and here's Being There. Sorry, found that one. That is 37. Yeah, Richard Pryor, Live in Concert, comes in at 25. So there's definitely a wider variety of films on Letterboxd. It's not as Hollywood-centric. But yeah, looking in those top 72, we have Apocalypse Now, All That Jazz, Breaking Away, and Kramer vs. Kramer. And putting those in sequence, Kramer vs. Kramer is actually the 4th out of the 5. So Norma Rae does not appear in the top 72. So Kramer vs. Kramer is the only one of the nominees I've seen, although I've owned Apocalypse Now for a few years. I'm not a huge fan of the war genre, so I haven't gotten around to it. Yeah, it looks like the historical ratings are putting Apocalypse Now as the best film of the year.
It's good. It's a dark film, both in subject matter and a lot of it is filmed in the dark. Coppola was trying to hide Brando's weight. I don't know. I just, while I am not a divorced parent, I just found it easier to connect to and understand the characters in Kramer versus Kramer when I couldn't with Apocalypse Now. I mean, not, and I'm not saying like I couldn't understand the movie, but you know, to me that's a more objective film. I'm not a soldier. I've never served overseas, so I can't relate to what's going on to Martin Sheen's character in Apocalypse Now. And while I'm not a divorced single parent, I am a father. I could relate to a lot of stuff that was going on in Kramer versus Kramer, even as a happily married parent. You know what I mean? So.
Oh, I know what you mean. Because just, you know, sitting there thinking what would happen if, you know, sometimes I have to stay at home on Sundays to get work done because of my job, and you know, wife and baby are out at the in-laws, and even that, it's like, okay, I want to go cuddle my daughter now. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't imagine what it'd be like saying, okay, you've got 2 weekends and 1 dinner a week, or 2 weekends a month and 1 dinner a week. That's so, yeah, I don't have to have been through that for it to resonate.
or the spilled juice on the papers, or the fight, the test of wills over the ice cream. I mean, those are all things parents can relate to.
Yep. Oh yeah, we have that. Our daughter's, she knows what food she likes. Thankfully, she likes a lot of food, but she has preferences. So if you think there's options, you know, she might be loving her Eggo waffle, but if daddy pulls out Cinnamon Toast Crunch, well, that Eggo is away and that hand is out going, more, more. Like, she wants some of the Cinnamon Toast Crunch that daddy shares. And, yeah, apparently there's some spoilage at grandma's house, too. So we can go into grandma's house and she will start going chocolate and start pointing and take me right to the chocolate and where it's kept. So grandma picks her up from daycare. So we know that she's been given a snack as soon as she gets here. It's like, okay, how many of those snacks are the chocolate chips here? Anyway, but no, she got lucky. Our daughter hit the jackpot with all of her grandparents. So you've already said that you think the Academy made the best choice. Mm-hmm. I am not in a position to judge because this is the only nominee I've seen. All I can really say is, yeah, the statistics say, you know, check out Apocalypse Now as well. And some of that, to your point, I don't know if we had gotten to Kramer versus Kramer before my wife got pregnant, I don't know that it would have resonated with me the way it did, because it's just different when you are a parent. Mm-hmm. So who would we recommend this to?
I think anyone who enjoys a good drama, anyone who enjoys character pieces, I think parents will find a lot that they can relate to in the relationship between Ted and Billy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. We haven't done content warnings as consistently as we used to because the films haven't necessarily warranted it. But we already mentioned there is maybe 5 seconds of nudity it's not voyeuristic. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, post-coitus, a woman gets up to use the bathroom, and Billy comes out into the hall. So it's not an erotic scene. It's meant to be awkward. And, you know, the actress was worried she was going to traumatize the child. But so that's just, be aware that that's in there. But I think we've already brought that up. But yeah, otherwise I would recommend it to, you know, like, you know, whether it's better than Apocalypse Now or not, I can't say, but it is very well made. And at this point, I have no issues with it taking home the big award. So if you've been in the parental role, divorced or not, you will have that. And I suspect even if you're not a parent, but your parents went through a divorce while you were a child, you might find that resonating here too. So shall we tell people what to expect next month?
Next month is the disintegration of a family, but that family is made up of ordinary people. Directed by Robert Redford, starring Donald Sutherland, Timothy Hutton, Judd Hirsch, and Mary Tyler Moore.
All right, so join us next month for that, where Ordinary People was nominated up against Coal Miner's Daughter, The Elephant Man, Raging Bull, and Tess. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, everyone.
My mom always said, life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
Please, sir, I want some more.